it's really worth paying attention, doing a kind of maintenance of friendships, almost like the way we would maintain our physical health, that we make sure that we stay in touch, that we nurture those relationships that are important to us. They don't just take care of themselves.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. In a very depressing world beset by wars, climate disasters, and disease, we're going to invite you to escape the pressing problems to focus on something positive, achievable, and beneficial for us all. I speak, of course, of friendship. It's an area which, quite frankly, deserves a lot more of our time and attention. If I told you that by just having one positive friend, you could increase your life expectancy by 10 years, would you scoff at me or prick up your ears? Well, in fact, it's true. Today, we're going to delve into the deeper mysteries and unknown facts about friendship, and hopefully you will leave the forum refreshed and ready to lengthen your life. Research is providing us with more and more proof that having friends is essential to our continued good health. Many people are aware of the detrimental effects that social isolation and loneliness can have on physical and mental well-being, but fewer of us appreciate the advantages of keeping important relationships close and personal. To help us understand the importance of friendship, we have two wonderful guests today. Dr. Bob Waldinger, a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, therapist and Zen priest, and Dr. Jan Jaeger, a sociologist, friendship expert, adjunct associate professor in the Department of Sociology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, City University of New York, and author of numerous books, including Friendgevity, Making and Keeping Friends Who Enhance and Extend Your Life. So, Bob, you have been directing one of the longest running studies of adult life, and you say deep, meaningful relationships are linked with emotional well-being and physical health.
So at one point in our study, we asked our participants, we said, list all the people who you could call in the middle of the night if you were sick or scared. And some people had no one, including people who were married. And some people could list quite a number. And I think some of what we're talking about are the more intimate kind of safety net kind of people in our lives. Like, who are those people? Like, who could we really go to if we were in trouble? And what we find is that having somebody in your life like that seems to convey a great deal of health benefit. And that it's possible then to have all kinds of different kinds of friends in your life, but having at least one person, and ideally a few people, who have your back and you just feel like they're there for you, that's an essential component.
And I want to shift things a little because one of the reasons I wrote Friendgevity is that When Friendship Hurts, my book before that, it dealt with the emotional disappointments, even sometimes romantic type of betrayals, but it didn't really get at the nitty gritty. And I think when we talk about friendship extending your life, we also have to talk about how it can end your life. And what made me think about this so dramatically is that in 2017, my husband's great nephew got into the car to go out with his friend for drinks on a Friday night. That's what 23 and 25 year olds do. And unfortunately, the driver crashed the car and our great nephew was killed instantly. The driver got 6 to 12 years for in state prison for reckless driving and driving under the influence, among other issues. And I have a whole chapter in Friendgevity called Frenemies and Fatal Friends, because too many people only look at friendship in a Pollyannish way. you know, oh, this friend's going to extend my life. Oh, friendship's great. I have someone to talk to and confide in. But there are life-changing issues related to friendship, you know, like what happened to our great nephew. You know, is the person that asked you to get in that car going to, are you just going to have a fun night out, or is it going to be the end? You know, I have a whole file of stories, you know, best friend cheerleaders, you know, killed in a crash, friend giving someone drugs that turns out to be, you know, laced with fentanyl, kills the friend. So I think that it's important when you talk about friendgevity and longevity and friendship to look at the good friends and the bad friends. And the bad friends may not just give you a stomach ache or make you feel depressed, but they can also, you know, there's a famous case, she went to prison where she actually sadly cajoled her friend into committing suicide.
Oh, right.
That was a very famous case in, I think, even Massachusetts, possibly. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important, you know, we want to keep it a nice, upbeat, light conversation, but I think it's very important to, you know, too many people see friendship as an extra that's thrown into your life rather than a really key part of all our lives.
So what you're pointing to is the need to pay attention to whether someone really has your interests at heart, whether someone really wants to take care of you or wants a partner in some foolish, reckless endeavor.
Oh, no, Louise, yeah.
Yeah.
No, and it's interesting because I teach penology at John Jay among victimology and other courses. And over the years, my students always have to do an interview. And I can't tell you how many of those interviews are about, you know, so-and-so led me on the down the garden path. You know, I had to do time in juvie because I got involved with the wrong friend. This friend was shoplifting and they talked me into doing it, you know. So, you know, there's a lot of that.
So we've got a question here. What do you suggest when someone you had considered a friend drifts away? If the person has removed themselves, is that usually indicative that he or she doesn't want further contact? I don't know whether to pursue any further conversation, ask directly if they're offended by something I said or did, or just move on. In the pandemic, my life telescoped down and a lot of fringe relationships fell away. Is that a common experience? So we got two questions there. Should you confront something and address it, or just let it kind of peter out? And secondly, resurrecting relationships that drifted during the pandemic?
Well, I think the first issue is how important is this friendship to you, the one who's drifted away? Is it once you do decide that it's important enough to say, hey, you know, I miss you. I value your friendship. What's going on? If they give you an answer that you can work with, great. They may just not want to answer you. They may ghost you. So at a certain point, you just have to take the hint and move on. But a lot of people found the pandemic scaled down their friendships and showed them who was going to be there for them.
It's kind of a risk-benefit calculation. What do I risk losing if I don't try to explore this friendship and keep it alive? And what do I risk if I reach out, you know? And so, you know, certainly if you let it go, you won't get it back by being silent. You will get the friendship back. You will revive it often by reaching out and just being curious. We haven't talked in a while. What's going on for you? Often, we imagine things about friendships that aren't true. And so simply being curious first, not assuming we know why someone stopped being in contact, but just asking the simple question may give us answers that are surprising and don't have much to do with us. And that can be a great relief.
That's interesting. But I do think you should only go so long on that path. If you're
you don't want to be accused of flogging a dead horse,
as we say.
Well, also today you don't want to be accused of stalking someone.
Well, I didn't think of that, but of course, yeah, that's another possible.
Yeah, well, also the other thing is put the shoe on the other foot. You know, in When Friendship Hurts, I talk about, you know, some of the skills when something is pulled, you know, is this a failed friendship? Is this something you can salvage? And one of the skills is to pretend you're at a movie theater and you're watching the movie. And, you know, if that was you, what would you want to have happen? You know, would you want to be confronted? Would you want to just have, and that's another part of it, cooling out. Sometimes what you think is a pulling away is just, hey, let me chill this out and see if I go back to them and things get back on track. So sometimes confrontation can backfire because it does that, you know, it makes it concrete. So that's another issue. Has it been a week? Has it been a month? Has it been 6 months? Was there something specific that happened? Or are they busy? Did they have a baby? Did they, you know, have something happen that you weren't tuned into? So once again, there's no one answer for everything. So you've got to really try to judge, you know, how does this person feel about confrontation? You know, they may be the last person in the world that you want to be asking things about. Someone else may say, great, I'm so glad you asked me. Let's talk about it.
The other thing is you can lead with why you're reaching out. You can simply say, I've missed you. That's not a confrontation. It's just, gee, I've missed you and I'd like to be in touch again.
Which takes the onus off the being some kind of thing that precipitated this.
Exactly.
Yeah. We've got a really great question here because I was going to ask, well, one thing is we haven't really talked about how things might change with age and life experience. But, you know, we live a lot longer now. People move around the country. People move around the world. I mean, it's quite hard work to maintain good friendships and you have to make the time. But before we move to that, Miguel from Spain has written, is there any country or culture in the world that may be ranked as number one concerning the value of loyalty and commitment with the value of friendship? Great question. Before, while you're thinking about that, I did read today that in Japan, where the average life expectancy is about 90 for women, people form these things called MOAs. You might know of them. They're groups of five people, friends, who offer social, logistic, emotional, and even financial support for a lifetime, which is wonderful. I don't know if they put it in writing, but anyway, it works.
Well, I, you know, over the years, I've interviewed quite a few networks like that. You know, they started in middle school. That's why middle school is such an important time, because your personality is already being formed and you're able to get together with people without as much interaction as with the parents, or in high school or college. And I've interviewed groups that go on annual retreats from college for 20 years. You know, my best friend, Joyce, she's in a sorority. When she retired, she had a wonderful party at a hotel. She had 40 of her sorority sisters from college at that party, in addition to her colleagues and her friends and family. So, you know, Americans, there are people like that. I had a friend from Venezuela.
Don't you think that's a cultural thing they've actually taken on board? It's a practice that they do in Japan.
Yes, Dan Buettner of the Blue Zones studied that culture. And they're assigned in these villages. They're assigned at age five. Their friend group is assigned.
Oh, so it's not even a chosen thing.
And it's quite wonderful. He has these videos of these women in their 90s, and they're the same groups that they were when they were 5 years old. And the instruction is, these are going to be your friends. These are going to be the people you can call if you're sick or scared in the middle of the night. And it works. And Dan, wow. Dan's idea.
Well, I prefer what my friend Joyce does, where she's chosen them from her sorority sisters.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I don't want to, I don't really want to get into
No, I Japan. Think culturally it's a great idea. Yeah, it's a great divide.
I don't see, I don't like the idea of being told when I'm five that there are five people that I have to interact with for the rest of my life.
Dan, that's not the point of this. The point of this is that there are cultures, and I think that's where the man who asked the question,
that's Spanish.
What he was talking about, that there are cultures that prioritize this.
And so do we. So
well, yes. Well, actually, though, actually, we don't necessarily prioritize this. There are certainly parts of our culture where we don't prioritize it. And I think he's, you know, the question is, are there countries in the world where this is more of a priority? It's a good question. One thing you might do, the questioner, you might look up the World Happiness Report. Every year, the United Nations publishes a report. You can get it online. The United Nations World Happiness Report. And they have studies of how different countries compare in their social engagement, in their community involvement. And that you might find that interesting if you're looking at how different parts of the world prioritize or don't prioritize.
Well, I want to share something very important, because one of the insights I got from all my research is how going from a pair, a friendship pair, to a triad often backfires. And I think that's one of the takeaways I want our listeners to know, that the structure of friendship can have as much to do with intimacy as the age or the gender. So keep that in mind. Sometimes when you have a pair and it's going well and you say, oh, it'll be more efficient, let me bring in my third friend. Well, a lot of times it doesn't go well, it backfires. So I think that's important for people to know. I think learning about the friendship patterns in America, and or if you're from around the world, I was going to mention my friend from Venezuela. I interviewed her on friendship. And what was so amazing was I asked her, if you were working with a friend and the boss said that there's something about the friendship that isn't working, what would you do? And she said that the friendship would come before the work. And a lot of Americans wouldn't say that. You know, they would say, oh, my job comes first.
Mm. By the way, there was another, this is just a random thing. I was reading a Guardian piece and it was entitled The Island Where Nobody Dies. And it was about a man who was living here. He was Greek by birth and he was given a diagnosis of lung cancer. And they said, you know, not good, probably 6 months. And he decided to forego all treatment. And he went back to this little Greek island basically to die, moved into his parents' house with his parents and started just gardening and then resurrected the friendships that he had had in the village. And 2.5 decades later, he's still there gardening away, happy as anything on the Greek island, which calls into question, you know, the therapy that he got from that environment. It was the cure. You know, being cared for by people that were, you know, able to speak his language, shared his interest in growing stuff. Simple as it sounds, worked. I thought it was a lovely piece. Lovely piece.
Well, and Mary, sometimes doctors are wrong in their diagnosis.
True. All right, quick one. This is a very important one here. Jude says, has social media helped or hurt friendships in general and the depth of friendship in particular? It's a great question. What do you think?
I've actually found when I started researching friendgevity, I thought it had hurt it. But from the interviews I did, and I surveyed over 800 people from around the world, it actually has been helping people. And I think what's important is that people got very savvy quickly. If you found out, if you got engaged, they learned you call your closest friends and you tell them, and then you post it on Facebook. You don't let your close network feel like they've become part of this broader group. So so people have learned how to make it work for their relationships. I think early on it was hurting people more, but as they learned how to make it work for them, going back to what I said about my nephew, my great nephew who passed away from the friendship related situation, his father posted on Facebook about the tragedy. And there were 1,000 people at his son's funeral. That would have been a lot harder to pull off if you didn't have the power of friendship and Facebook.
Well, one of the things we're learning is that much depends on how you use the internet, how you use social media. So if you use it to connect with people in the way you were describing, Jan, where you know, you connect, you let people know what's happening in your life, and then people show up in real time, in real life. That's an active use of social media to connect. Mm. There's another way that we often use social media, which is essentially doom scrolling, looking at other people's curated lives. Though that makes us feel worse, it often makes us feel more isolated. It often lowers self-esteem. So what we find is that the more active use, where we reach out to friends and maintain connections, that active use strengthens friendships and it elevates mood. And the more passive use has the reverse effect.
I don't want to miss one of the questions was about spouses.
Yeah, I just noticed
that. And I think that's very important because I interviewed a woman years ago who was best friends with a man for 10 years. And she was very upset because he had gotten married and his new wife said, unfortunately, yeah, I'm paraphrasing, but the gist of it was, unfortunately, I can't handle your friendship with so-and-so. And she just was, you know, said, oh, this marriage isn't going to work out. How could he do this to me? And I think that it's very important to understand that going back to one size doesn't fit all. There are spouses who are fine with their romantic partner having a platonic relationship, either a new one or a long-standing one. And there are others who it does make them jealous. And we're not talking about jealousy like a domestic violence kind of control freak situation. It just doesn't feel comfortable. So some of the ways to deal with that is if, and not even with opposite sex friendships, even with same-sex friendship, you know, get together with your friends without your spouse, without making a big deal about it. You know, you don't have to brag about it or, you know, drag couples into it if the four people don't get along. But in friendships, I talk about marriage a lot because it is one of the biggest friendships. There's very few people who will say that getting married didn't impact their friendship in some way.
One of my colleagues, Eli Finkel, has written a book called The All or Nothing Marriage, in which he talks about the kind of modern ideal that you're supposed to be able to get everything you need from your spouse, from your romantic partnership, and that this is most often not the case in most couples, but that it can lead people to have false expectations and then be disappointed because they're not able to get everything they need, a spouse. And so the idea is that when partners have more realistic expectations, they're not threatened by spouses having friendship networks and relying on friends for certain essential things in their lives.
I think that's always a tricky one. The perfect platonic relationship invariably leads to some form of imbalance. That's my experience. Very few people are able to cope with it because the possibility of it being more than friendship is always lurking, unless you're terribly stable and very trusting and established. Correct? Would you agree with that?
Are you talking about
mixed, when you've got a heterosexual, well,
I see,
right? A heterosexual person.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You've got a male heterosexual friend outside the marriage. It can be a stressor.
But many times spouses are threatened by, you know, friendships where there isn't sexual attraction, where there's no real possibility.
Right. It's the time thing that they have.
Yeah, it's the time thing. And that's
I think it goes to, you know, just handling it in a way that it doesn't become an issue. You know, that's really, you know, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, taking up cooking or going out with a friend. It's a question of how you incorporate it into your life so that if the husband or the wife is getting all she or he needs, they're not going to be threatened by it. So it's really a question of, you know, making it work. And, you know, but I in friend shifts, I have an anecdote where there was this couple at my old building in Manhattan, and they were everything to each other. And when the husband died, it was so sad because within a few months, his wife, just who had no friends, and her children were too busy to get together with her. And she was only in her mid to late 50s, but she so deteriorated that the family had to hire a nurse to take care of her. And I used to see her walking up and down the street. And I always knew that if she just had some kind of a friendship network, because even if you're the happiest married person in the world, statistically, one of the spouses is going to pass away before the other, and they will need a network to lift them up while they make the transition to whatever happens after that.
So I think we're all agreed that we should definitely seek out and keep good close friends and nurture them, because our health and their health depends upon it, right? It's a mutual win-win.
25 years ago, I started International New Friends, Old Friends Week. And it's the first Sunday, it's the Sunday after Mother's Day in America. And it lasts for a whole week. And I did it because I knew instinctively that as time went on, more and more women were not going to have a mother to celebrate Mother's Day with, but they would have their friends.
It's really worth paying attention, doing a kind of maintenance of friendships, almost like the way we would maintain our physical health, that we go to the gym and we exercise, and we don't just do it once and then say, oh, my body will take care of itself now. I did my workout. Mm-hmm. We really make choices each day, each week, to make sure that we stay in touch, that we nurture those relationships that are important to us. They don't just take care of themselves. And I think that's one of the take homes that's worth putting out there for our listeners.
You've been listening to Can Having Good Friends Prolong Your Life? Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Dorothy and Herbert Vetter, the Lowell Institute, the Mass Cultural Council, and you. If you'd like to donate, please visit the website cambridgeforum.org. There you will also find podcasts of this and other programs. Thank you all again for joining us.